We're here today to talk about the future of education, specifically No Child Left Behind. We're having a special meeting at the initiation of Congresswoman Betty McCollum, and we're going to gather your suggestions, comments, as Congress is now in the position of looking at reauthorization. We have discussed this important topic in previous committee meetings this year, as you know. But right now, the stage is in Washington, and school districts throughout Minnesota, across America, are posing a lot of questions, a lot of concerns, and we'd like to get that testimony on the record today from those of you in Minnesota, particularly as it's going to help Congresswoman McCollum. So I'd like to welcome and thank Congresswoman Betty McCollum for asking us to convene, and she's going to share some remarks before we open it up for testimony.
Well, thank you, Senator Wieger, and thank you for making this happen today. I have been meeting with parent groups and folks from all around here and the nation on Leave No Child Behind, and I know we're in good hands because the first time I met you, you were running for school board and you recruited me, and I felt well served by you then, and I know you have a real passion for public education, so I really look forward to hearing what's going to be shared with us today. Thank you.
Thank you. We have several people that are listed for testifying, and if there's anyone that's not on the list that would like to also join us, just indicate it through a note up here, and we'll do our best to accommodate. Also, if you have a time restriction where you need to testify before 11 or some other reason, please bring that to our attention as well. Otherwise, it's our intent to go with the agenda, starting with parents speaking in their role as parents. So first, we'd like to welcome at the table parents Craig Roan, St. Paul, and Marita Bujold. St. Paul, and for you and each of our witnesses, if we could ask that you state your name for the record.
Thank you. I'm Marita Bujold, and I have two daughters who have attended public schools in St. Paul. And thank you for inviting testimony today from Parents United for Public Schools. I'm a member of the board and have been for the last 5 years. Like the vast majority of the members.
Excuse me, Ms. Bujold, for the record, most of us know what Parents United are, but if you could just give a pitch for what the organization does statewide.
Parents United is a statewide organization that assists parents in advocacy for public schools. Our primary mission is to create an atmosphere in the state that is advantageous for public education, helps students and communities and teachers do the best for public schools.
Okay.
Like the vast majority of our members, I have volunteered in a variety of ways on behalf of my daughter's schools. Over the last 12 years, those opportunities to volunteer have helped me understand some of the challenges facing our schools. As I became more familiar with the challenges, I drew the same conclusions that others have. I do have issues with our public schools. But whatever those issues are, I want them to have the resources which they need to serve all of our students. Public schools have served students in the United States for a little over a century. And in that relatively brief time, everything has changed dramatically. The population, the science, the technology, we could make a list in this room miles long. Public schools reflect today's population in the United States. It's no surprise that the schools face significant challenges. I believe that we need to provide reforms in the schools. Reform which will make it possible for schools to help every student succeed. I do not think that the provisions of No Child Left Behind address those needs. Under the provisions of No Child Left Behind, every school in the state of Minnesota is destined to be marked as a failing school at some point. In other words, there is no way to succeed. No matter what the efforts the schools make, under the current guidelines, all schools will fail. This is not the kind of reform which serves schools, students, and their communities. We need a plan which will address the educational needs of our population. If we listen to the latest research about how children and adolescents learn, we will have a very good chance of creating a successful approach to providing education. As a parent, volunteer, and as a citizen, I find No Child Left Behind Act an insult not only to my intelligence, but to the hours of labor and effort which I have dedicated to the schools and which thousands of other parents have dedicated. We have tremendous resources in this country, and our nation's economy relies on an educated workforce. Public schools educate the vast majority of that workforce. We need to address issues of reform and resources which will truly provide a first-class 21st century education. No Child Left Behind does not make the grade.
Thank you.
Good morning, Senator Wieger. My name is Craig Rowan. First, I'd like to thank you for allowing me to testify here today. I am also a parent of two girls in the St. Paul Public School District. One is in sixth grade, one is in third grade. I'm also the parent co-chair of my school's, my children's school's site council, and I've served on a half a dozen ad hoc committees and task forces at the district level in terms of budgetary and policy issues. So from my perspective, I feel like I've got kind of a ground zero perspective on the implications of both tax and education policy that's set at the state level as well as at the federal level. I'm sympathetic to the state's Hobson's choice with regard to No Child Left Behind. I understand that we really don't have much of a choice in terms of accepting or rejecting the mandates, because if we reject them, we lose federal funding. And given our current fiscal problems as they are with our public schools, I don't think we can afford to lose our federal funding. However, there are things that at the state level that can be addressed vis-a-vis No Child Left Behind. And specifically, I want to focus for a moment on our testing model. From my perspective and from the perspective of many, many teachers and administrators that I've talked to, the current testing model that we use in the state is counterproductive. It's a static model, it's rigid, and probably most importantly, it provides no usable feedback for our educators. As Marita indicated, under the current model and under No Child Left Behind, according to a legislative audit report that was conducted, we are assured of failing to make AYP in virtually all of our schools throughout the state by 2014. This is not an urban issue. It's not a suburban issue. It's not a rural issue. All schools, all public schools, will be caught up in that net, unfortunately. There are a lot of flaws with the MCAs. There's a lot of problems with the way it measures and what it measures, and I'm not going to get into any detail, and I'm certainly no expert, but let me give you one example. At my children's school, Groveland Park Elementary School, historically, we've done quite well on our testing. 2 years ago, the school, with open arms, brought in over 100 new Hmong children from the last refugee camp in Thailand. And these kids spoke no English, virtually no English. As a result, the scores dropped precipitously for that cell of children defined as Asian. This year, we just squeaked by and have gotten the first year's by, if you will, because it's the first year in which we've seen a single cell drop in scores. We fully expect next year we won't get that by, and because we have a lag time with these new immigrant children, we will probably not make AYP, and the school will be labeled for that reason. At the very least, I'm hoping that the state reconsiders the way we test our children. We really need to move toward a growth model that provides per pupil meaningful data that can be looped back to educators so that they can actually use it. We also need to identify those areas that of student populations that are being measured, but being measured inappropriately, such as the group that I just mentioned. It makes no sense in a state that has the influx of new immigrants that we've been having to treat all students in terms of testing the same way because their circumstances are different. You cannot expect a child who's just come out of a camp in Thailand who speaks no English, has had no formal education, to be up and running within 2 years. It's just not a practical or meaningful measure. The third downside that I've seen with our static testing model is more and more teachers, like it or not, are teaching to the test. They're spending more and more time prepping their kids to take a test. And at our school, we euphemistically call, I think it's April, we call it testing month. There's virtually no actual learning that goes on. What everybody does is practice and get ready for the test. That is a perversion of our educational system driven by a policy that is questionable. I'd like to thank you again for having us here. Again, I'm no expert on this, but I've seen from a parent's perspective and at the school level perspective the damage that No Child Left Behind has done. I strongly urge the Minnesota legislature to do what it can to mitigate the damage that seems to be year after year being inflicted on our schools by at least, at bare minimum, addressing the way we measure our students' progress. Thank you.
Thank you. Congresswoman McCollum.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. When refer to the testing, the reason why you feel that it's not really adequate and maybe helping your child or the child that's currently there is the tests come back after the child's left. So it's testing the grade level, not the child. So it's not being used diagnostically. Is that your opinion of the testing?
Well, I didn't even get into that, but yes. For anybody who's familiar with how the MCAs work, they're not actually testing an individual student's progress. They're testing a class level's progress, and then they measure the next year against that. So they're not. It's like going to the doctor, getting an examination, having the doctor say you're physically fit, but actually it's your wife that you wanted to have diagnosed with something that may be wrong with her. The doctor looking at me has nothing to do with the health of my wife. Essentially, that's the way the MCAs work. You're testing a completely different group that's moved on, and then you're measuring them against the next group that comes up. It doesn't even measure the children that are being tested.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, are you aware of any discussions that have taken place with parents? There was a recent Pioneer Press article that highlighted how art, music classes were being reduced in the schools, time for testing, and also because of financial constraints on the school districts. Have parents been discussing what they feel is going on for a well-rounded, creative child? We know that children who take music take foreign languages do better in math and science. So can you maybe give us a feel for what the parents are saying?
Well, I think that you would find statewide there are issues with how many reductions of services have happened in the last several years. And what we've found is that's largely because we don't have the amount coming from the state that we need to have sustainable funding for our programs. And then you add to that the expenses that come from lack of special ed funding, lack of funding from No Child Left Behind, lack of, and then the extra costs that come from transportation and health care. Those are things that we can't do anything about as schools. Those are just market issues. So you can go to Ely, you can go to Hibbing, you can go to Rochester, you can go to any of our public schools in the metro area, and you'll find parents saying, we have fewer programs in a variety of areas due to that problem. As the resources have dwindled, there is no sustainability. So at least I know in our schools, in St. Paul Public Schools, where you have site councils. As Craig mentioned, he's on the site council at his school. You have the principal, the parents, and the teachers who get together to make a plan for the year, and they evaluate what kind of programs they need for their students and what they believe they need to accomplish. Then they look at the resources they have, which are inadequate, and then they make cuts. And this has been happening year after year after year. So you have people who are really trying to do the job, but they are unable to serve the students because the resources are dwindling. And No Child Left Behind definitely plays a role in this. As Craig mentioned, if you're spending all your time teaching to the test, you are going to set aside other things that are part of the program.
If I may, very briefly, and I know there are a lot of people here to testify, I can give you a very concrete example of how No Child Left Behind has negatively impacted other areas of education, such as music and art. Our superintendent, Dr. Maria Kerstarfen, who's pretty new to our district, has come in and has focused on, she's a very numbers-oriented person. She's a savant when it comes to statistics and performance and that sort of thing. And she has rolled out a strategic plan for the St. Paul Public Schools District that is quite extensive and solicited public responses, had a series of open houses, if you will, which I went to. And she had set up a number of stations. And I went looking for the station to talk to people about the music programs and the art programs. And I asked, where is it? And nobody could point me in any direction. Ultimately, I got sent over to the nice people who were taking feedback on transportation. Don't know why, but there was nobody else to talk to. And I said, there's nothing in your strategic plan that speaks to music or art or the humanities. And the response that I got was, well, we don't have a strategic plan for that because it's really not measured and it's not measurable by the tests that we administer, and therefore we're putting our resources into those programs that are measured. So it just gets kicked off the bus. I was shocked, but that seems to be the case in Minnesota, where we have over 40,000 children being educated, and we're losing our arts programs and our humanities programs and our music programs because MCAs don't test for it.
Thank you. We'll take one more question. And Senator Saltzman.
I spent the last 2 days of last week with some of the people in this room at a conference in Rochester where 750 educators and superintendents came together to talk about early intervention services. And one quote, one of the comments really has stuck with me, and that is, why do we weigh cows? Why do we weigh cows? Do we weigh cows because the more we weigh them, they're going to gain more weight? Or do we weigh cows because we want to find out if we're feeding them enough? And so that goes to testing. If what we're going to do is test kids and think that the more we test them, they're going to achieve more, we're never going to achieve anything. Whereas I think that we do need to be careful here, because I do believe that testing, appropriate, useful testing that teachers can use, is extremely useful. And that was really the intent of this conference, is how we use very frequent monitoring to determine if the interventions that we are using is appropriate. It's like a doctor. If you take a temperature, you want to see if you're responding to like the medication. And that's, I think, where we absolutely have to have accountability. But it's when you think of No Child Left Behind and all you think of is a test that you get 6 months later, which really is not going to impact how the teacher addresses the achievement of that child, we have a problem. And that's, I think, I hope what this discussion is about today is, how tests, how we find out how we're doing and how we're going to address student achievement is not by opening up the Star Tribune or the Pioneer Press on a Monday after test scores comes out. It's how we're going to use evaluations to truly impact the achievement of kids. And I do know that I was with Dr. Pasternak, who was a former undersecretary in the Department of Education, and he talked about that apparently the House language with the renewal does have some new language possibly about early intervention, the RTI, that we've talked a lot about in this committee. So I hope that we can also frame some of our discussion today on what is appropriate when we look at monitoring children and accountability. That's more of a statement than a question.
Oh, thank you, Senator Saltzman.
Thank you for your question.
And thank you to the parents, and we'll note some of the suggestions you mentioned for a growth model, testing of special populations, et cetera. We have the Commissioner of Education, Commissioner Segrin, here. I'm sure that that'll be incorporated, too, in her remarks. So, good.
Thank you.
Our next panel will include teachers, and we'll ask the four testifiers if they could please join us at the table. And if there's any special requests, just keep field those up to us so we're aware of it. Tom Doerr, Robin Currier, Corey Mattson, and Lisa Marie Miller-Selner are listed. So, Mr. Doerr, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tom Doerr. I am president of Education Minnesota, and I am proud to represent the views of 70,000 educators, who include school staff and higher education faculty, who are members of Education Minnesota at this hearing. I come before you today as a middle school educator with nearly 20 years of classroom experience, and my testimony is informed not only by my personal teaching experience, but also the work I have done in numerous professional capacities on behalf of Minnesota educators at the local, state, and national level. I grew up in the Robbinsdale School District. I've been a teacher in the Robbinsdale School District for nearly 20 years, and I have gained much as a student there and gained much as an educator there, and I have never forgot the impact that teachers and coaches and mentors had on my life. Quite simply, they're the reason why I became a teacher, and I'm sure that many of you have similar stories on why you went into public service. I'm here today to comment on the reauthorization of No Child Left Behind, portions of the Federal Elementary and Education Secondary Education Act. We also have the three teachers with me who will be testifying on the impact of No Child Left Behind on teaching and student learning in the classroom. We're very concerned that this process not be rushed simply to meet an artificial deadline or limited merely to tweaking the existing law. There are too many fundamental problems with No Child Left Behind to leave it as is. Reauthorization gives us a tremendous opportunity to finally get it right, to take a comprehensive look at whether federal policies are in line with what teachers and researchers know about how children learn and what makes a successful school. One fundamental problem with the law is its overemphasis and over-reliance on standardized test scores in the three subject areas right now, math, science, and reading. In practice, this excessively narrow focus is actually reducing access to a comprehensive curriculum and learning opportunities that struggling students need in order to reach and catch up with their peers. Just this past week, an article in the St. Paul Pioneer Press documented the decline in the fine arts instruction and other elective opportunities throughout Minnesota schools as it focused their limited budgets on subjects that will be tested. And you just heard that from the parents also. As teachers, we know that all children need exposure to a broad range of learning, and especially those children whose life experience outside of school is limited. It's the totality of a student's school experience, not just drilling and testing in two or three subjects, that leads to academic success. In the words of Reg Weaver, the president of the National Education Association, we should care as much or more about whether a child graduates after receiving a comprehensive, high-quality education as we do about how he or she performs on a standardized test. I would like to outline a few other major problems with No Child Left Behind Act. First, the idea of adequate yearly progress, as described in the current law, is extremely inadequate. Let's be clear that AYP has nothing to do with a student or a school's progress. It is simply a snapshot on any given day of a student and a school and a school district. This concept needs to be changed so that growth can become the criterion which schools are judged by. Second, the expectations placed on schools for adequate progress each and every year are unrealistic, and the sanctions applied when schools fail to meet the goal are not helpful in raising student achievement. And I would refer back to President Eisenhower when he was trying to get more math and science. What he did is he provided incentives. And to this very day, we still have Eisenhower grants that are for math and science projects. The belief that schools can and should bring a major change in a single year is simply not based in reality. A three-year goal improvement is a much more realistic idea. Third, the federal funding does not match expectations in the mandates of the law, and it must be significantly increased. Fourth, the system for judging the performance of special education students and English language learners needs an overhaul. Simply by the definition of those two groups, they are not where they should be, and to expect that they're going to make that progress, it would be like me going to Italy and being put in a school and then at the end of the year testing my Italian proficiency when I just started there. And it's just not a realistic goal. It's also unfair to penalize schools with higher percentage of these students simply because of their performance of these groups. Minnesota's public schools are very focused on helping these students progress academically, but it's counterproductive to punish schools when students who have these extra challenges do not have do not advance as rapidly as others at their grade level. I've already referred to the shortcomings of adequate yearly progress and the narrow and counterproductive emphasis on testing in those three subject areas. In addition, we believe test scores are too limited as a basis for judging performance of our schools. To give the public a more complete and accurate view of school performance, states should be allowed to use more than just test scores and allowing for measurement of student learning. I would like to remind you that the purpose of the No Child Left Behind Act was designed for overall education system accountability. If the system is not producing the desired outcomes, then all parts of the system should be held accountable. Students and schools will only be successful if the federal and state lawmakers provide funding and resources to schools to adequately fund small class sizes, education programs, facilities, and learning opportunities for all school districts. Another important component for student success is a highly qualified licensed teacher and ongoing professional development for school staff so that they're able to meet the diverse needs of our students. So those are a few things that need to be addressed during the reauthorization of No Child Left Behind. But I want to emphasize again that simply addressing a few individual problems in the existing law is not enough. Both Education Minnesota's national affiliates, the American Federation of Teachers, and the National Education Association are pursuing positive agendas for change in NCLB reauthorization. We want federal lawmakers to understand that improving student achievement takes things like early childhood education, class size reduction, safe and modern facilities, and a real attempt to infuse 21st century skills and innovation into our schools. Testing alone does not get the job done. In summary, Education Minnesota believes that in order to make the reauthorization successful, it should include accountability that rewards success and supports educators to help students learn. It should include smaller class sizes to improve student achievement. Also, quality licensed educators in every classroom and school. Students in schools should be supported by active and engaged parents, families, and communities, and resources to ensure that a great public school for every child. The current No Child Left Behind policy is bad policy. Changes to the No Child Left Behind Act must be carefully focused on what students and our public schools really need in order to succeed. It is worth taking the time to get it right. It is time to implement a program that is fair, equitable, and provides incentives and opportunities for success. We all know that students are much more than a test score. Thank you.
Thank you. And among the other three teachers, however you'd like to.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Robin Currier. This is my 24th year of teaching elementary students. Currently, I teach 4th and 5th grade math and the fine arts K through 6. I have the privilege of teaching at Bridges Community School, Mankato's only non-traditional elementary school that has a tradition of great success. I believe we have been successful due to our small learning groups, our parent support, and focused learning on the Minnesota standards. However, despite our success, No Child Left Behind is beginning to dictate mandated requirements that are having a negative impact in our school and, more importantly, district-wide. Teachers are held to required minutes to teach reading and math. We are given mandatory pacing guides that students must adhere to in order to make adequate learning progress before that first testing date. We are losing the curriculum to educate the whole child, curriculum that motivates students and initiate personal involvement in their learning. We are to assume that all students enter school with the same level of readiness and will progress through the system at the same rate and success. No Child Left Behind has forgotten that children are individuals and that their learning is impacted by a variety of variables within and outside the school environment. There are readiness, health, emotional, and language barriers. No Child Left Behind punishes schools that tend to have a large number of barriers rather than recognizing the need to assist their learning environment. We began school on September 6th with students. September 12th was our first round of fluency testing K through 6. We begin our standardized assessment September 24th. We complete a second round of fluency testing in November. I haven't learned all of the names of the students in my school yet, and we have 8 to 10 names currently on our collaboration list. We will be meeting on Wednesday for 35 minutes to discuss the needs of these children, 5 of which appear to be severely at risk. This concerns me. After our collaboration of 35 minutes on these 10 children, we start teaching. Saturday, 5 of our 7 staff members were busy volunteering their time at school to prepare for this week's lesson. Teachers have always been accountable to our students. No Child Left Behind has had a positive impact to not only increasing our accountability, but making our learning more purposeful. But some areas need to be addressed. Please rewrite No Child Left Behind and remove the system of accountability and punishment. Promote a program of accountability and support. Promote a system that is written for individual performance and individual growth, not equality. We all develop at different stages. Promote and celebrate all areas of growth and success individually. Rewrite the mandates to remove that removes funding from low-performing schools and meet the funding requirements of No Child Left Behind to meet the needs of students in low-performing schools. Let the assessment measures celebrate growth rather than provide a blanket comparison, assuming that all kids, ignoring the variables, are equal in their ability to learn at the same rate. Remove the punitive consequences and threats. Celebrate good teaching models, and provide monetary support to duplicate those models. Involve current teachers and the committee when rewriting No Child Left Behind. Ask them what their students need. Recognize the level of professionalism teachers have and support their efforts through funding. And finally, recognize and care for the children we are responsible for. They are not robots that respond to learning requirements because it is the third day of the fourth month of their 7th year. Some come hungry. Some carry burdens we don't understand. Some are fresh, clean, and ready to go. They may have slept in their car last night. They may have had a good night's sleep. Some may be sleeping at school while others can't get enough learning. Help us to celebrate their differences and their achievements, no matter how small or large the gain. I have yet to meet a student that is incapable of learning. They don't exist. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Creer.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Corey Mattson. I teach English Language Learners, or ESL, at Cleveland Junior High in the St. Paul Public Schools. I wish first to thank Betty McCollum for convening this hearing, and also would like to add that Mary Catherine Ricker, president of St. Paul Federation of Teachers, wishes that she can be here today with us testifying, but she's on a field trip with students. As I said, I work at Cleveland Junior High in the St. Paul Public Schools, teaching English to English language learners who are at the beginning level of learning the language to high beginning in the 7th and 8th grades. I'm speaking both as an English language teacher at Cleveland and also a member of the St. Paul Federation of Teachers. First, I'd like to say a little bit about the school where I teach. Students at Cleveland come from all over the world. They bring with them their diverse life experiences and cultures, and we try our best to celebrate those cultures in their academic learning. These students come from Southeast Asia, Latin America, countries from all over Africa, as well as from here in the United States. When looking for a job a few years ago, I was hired to teach at Cleveland to teach the new Hmong refugees from Thailand. I never imagined myself to be so fortunate to teach these students and work at a school such as Cleveland. People who visit our school, educators from other states, district administrators, and parents, remark about the student learning that is going on within its halls and say how the school has such a safe and nice learning environment. I believe that this is the case because Cleveland Junior High has a dedicated staff. We work hard to help students who might not have had the same material advantages as students in other schools. We recognize the social inequalities of our society, struggling to close the achievement gap, even when budget cuts and test-driven curriculum go against our efforts. My own students, who are beginning English language learners, are extremely hardworking. They have shown tremendous progress in the short time they have been at our school, approximately 1 or 2 years. Some of them come to our school with very little literacy. Some come from a background of literacy in their home country and succeed a little bit better. But regardless, all of them come with a degree of enthusiasm for learning that is just simply remarkable. And this is what motivates me to do a great job teaching them, to embrace staff development in our school, and to collaborate with other teachers to promote student learning. All of these positive developments at our school, all these positive aspects, you wouldn't know by looking at our NCLB test scores. And you wouldn't know these positive developments by considering that we are in our fourth year of failing to meet adequate yearly progress. These positive developments and the dedication of our teachers, I believe, are happening in spite of No Child Left Behind. So where is the mismatch? Where is the mismatch between what people say of our school, including administrators and parents, and what the tests say? One problem my colleagues and I feel that is extremely important to address is the inappropriate assessment of the English language learners at our school, who comprise 65% of our school population. Last year, the ELL department discovered that English language learners in our school who had been in the country for just 1 year would be taking the NCLB-mandated reading and math tests. Previously, there had been a 2-year exemption for these students. Now it would be just a 1-year exemption. Dozens of students, up to 70 students in total, took the test for the first time. I want to stress that these students are extremely hardworking. You should have seen them taking the test, trying their very best, taking it very, very seriously, and it was painful for us teachers to know that this test was an impossible one for them to take and to pass. I can't imagine being in their shoes. In a short 1 or 2 time span, these English language learners have progressed remarkably, starting from a pre-kinder reading level and progressing to a third grade and sometimes fourth grade reading level in such a short time. That's a little lower for the kids who haven't been in school before. Maybe they've gotten to second grade. But regardless, the progress is remarkable. Nevertheless, the government expects that these students take a 7th or 8th grade reading test to show their progress. All the progress they've made and what their teachers did to help them in the last few years didn't get registered on a test that was so above their reading level. In fact, I think that our school failed in one AYP category last year simply due to the participation of these hardworking students. They say that these tests are to improve teacher quality, but our dedication as an ELL staff cannot come from these inappropriate assessments. Other problems we see with No Child Left Behind are that it's extremely punitive and solely reliant upon tests. At our school, many of us believe that the purpose of an accountability system and tests is to improve or to help us do our jobs by diagnosing student need and directing appropriate resources and staff development to where it's most needed. But NCLB is based upon very onerous sanctions that actually penalize and hurt schools. This happens at Cleveland in a number of ways. First, our school is required by No Child Left Behind to send letters home every year to parents saying that we are a school in need of improvement. Because of these letters alone, some students leave every year, not because they would necessarily do better at a different school educationally, but because they don't like the uniforms or they have a friend in a different school. The letter, we believe, is what spurs the decision. And as a result, the school further loses students and then further loses funding. Along these same lines, Students who might hear that we have an excellent science program or a service learning social studies curriculum might choose not to enroll with us simply because of our test scores, which we believe is unfair. We believe this does not help reverse the trend of resegregation in our schools. In concluding my testimony, I'd like to give my opinion and that of many of my colleagues that No Child Left Behind is flawed fundamentally and needs a complete overhaul. As it now stands, the negative effects of the law greatly outstrip the little that is positive. If not completely changed, not just tinkered with, the opinion I hear most is that it won't work, and worse, it could destroy schools such as my own. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Matson.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
I just have to say, my folks graduated or went to Cleveland in the 30s, and my wife went there in the 60s, I guess. And to just hear your testimony on how that school has changed, because in the 30s, it was probably English and maybe some Swedish being spoken as a foreign language. And to hear now that there's so many different languages there. But I do appreciate your testimony on what's going on there now. And also heard your concerns that, you know, it's not real. No Child Left Behind is really not answering the problem. So thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Marie Miller-Selner. First of all, thank you for this honor of speaking to you today. When asked to testify in front of the Minnesota Senate Committee here on the impact NCLB has had on my classroom, my students, and my teaching, I felt it was imperative that I allow you to understand my experience. I started my teaching career 15 years ago. I teach at Tartan High School in Oakdale, Minnesota, which is in the North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale School District, which borders St. Paul. Currently, I teach special education American literature, special education speech and communications, resource and learning skills, and special education math. I have 28 students on my caseload, in which I develop IEPs, which are individualized education programs, behavior modification plans, third year and initial reevaluations of qualifying for special education services. My students range from having EBD, which is emotional behavioral disorders, specific learning disabilities, or SLD, other health impaired, which is OHI, or the big umbrella, which is ADD, ADHD, and TBI, which is traumatic brain injury students, and also two students with Asperger's spectrum disorder. I teach around 200 students with disabilities within one trimester alone. My teaching scenario is very typical of our country. Today, 14%, some 6.6 million of our nation's school-aged children receive some level of additional support through special education. These children come from all race and ethnic backgrounds and speak many different languages. The vast majority of their day is spent in the general education classroom, with 48% spending more than 80% of their day in general ed. It's extremely important to realize that these students have curriculum and instructional materials that are the same for all students. No Child Left Behind requires states to institute rigorous testing for students to measure their progress in math, reading, and science. Under the legal protections of IDEA, which is the Individuals with Disability Act, which is supposed to protect our students with disabilities because it allows equal access under the law for special education student services to each child's least restrictive environment, IDEA provides eligible students with special education and related services. However, under No Child Left Behind, it's as if IDEA does not exist. Why? A school can fail to make AYP, which is academic yearly progress, if fewer than 95% of students are present to take two standardized tests. A school can fail to make AYP if even one subgroup test based on race, ethnicity, special needs, English proficiency, or low income status does not meet AYP standards. How does NCLB affect my students? On testing days, they don't want to come to school. Many don't even want to be there because the testing is so rigorous and they don't come. They'll say, Mrs. Selner, seriously, I can't even read half of this. Why are they expecting us to do this? This summer I had the opportunity of teaching a class designed for passing the BSTs. The students, most general education students, studied for 2 weeks straight to pass the BSTs because they had failed already. And this was their last chance. One student in particular, I'll call her Sarah, She suffered from test anxiety, terribly. She went through graduation, like everyone else last June. She finished all her required classes. She is working full-time at a retail store, and she wants desperately to go to Century College. She's a fun, great young lady with the rest of her life in front of her, but the state is holding her diploma and her opportunity to succeed in our society. She knows that without a college education, she will not be able to support a family. She has seen her mother and her father struggle, working 40-plus hours each week. Sarah does want this. She wants more for herself. She does not want that. Her parents expect more for her. Yet no child left behind is leaving her behind. Ironic, isn't it? How does No Child Left Behind affect my teaching? It impacts me and my ability to teach. Oftentimes on testing days, I am dealing with several of my students having panic attacks and or tears, several students having behavior problems because they don't want to be there. Testing raises stress levels on all the teachers and the students, creating the learning environment that is filled with tension. Don't get me wrong, I believe all schools should have high expectations for all students and that educators should be accountable for their progress in helping children. But as my colleagues and myself try to implement NCLB, we are finding serious flaws in the law that prevent a fair and accurate assessment of student progress or educator quality. It has caused each of us to teach to the test. Learning beyond the classroom becomes difficult with yearly tests looming ahead. Learning beyond, in some states, teacher pay and job depends on the results of NCLB. I see this as unreasonable because there are so many variables that come into play when looking at the scores of a student. Students may not test well. The student may have a reading disability. The student's parents are getting a divorce. They're going through a tough time. Or maybe even, and this happened to me, one student's brother was shot the weekend before in a gang fight. The list can go on and on. The variables that play into each of one of my students varies from day to day. My nearest example to my heart is my American literature class last year. Out of 15 special education students, all with many different disabilities, 9 had parents who were divorced, 3 students had never met their father, 4 students' first language was not English, and the ethnicity and race of each student varied. There was no more whites, no more blacks, no more Hmongs, no more Hispanics. We are all equal. We're in the classroom. Did I mention that this is a junior-senior class and 6 students could not read past the third grade level? Students do not overcome disabilities if there's do not overcome learning disabilities. It is their disability that they have to live with and throughout time prevail over the disability. After all, Albert Einstein had his disability. Do you think he would have made AYP? One would have to ask oneself, if Einstein would have taken the test, would he have passed? Probably not, because he was able to show his brilliance even though he had a learning disability and severe ADHD. NCLB imposes a mandate on schools that is imposed on no other institution in the society. Imagine a federal law that declared that 100% of all citizens must have adequate health care in 12 years, or sanctions will be imposed on doctors and hospitals, or crimes must be eliminated in 12 years, or the local police department will face privatization. NCLB is shaming because schools get painted, and the shame that is imposed is frustrating. As a teacher, I truly love it, and the shame that is imposed on school because of test scores is insupportive of what education is all about. I have watched programs being cut, teachers and parent educators being laid off within the last 3 years. Programs such as music, facts, phi ed, shop classes in the arts have been cut so we can focus on reading and math. My students are losing the classes they need in order to fundamentally survive and be functional in our country. NCLB is justly a time bomb ticking at the heart of public education and threatening massive destruction from multiple directions. For all its horrors, there are still lots of reasons to believe that it can be effectively opposed or modified before it's too late. The law needs to provide adequate funding if NCLB is to achieve its goal. The law needs to recognize that there is a shortage of special education teachers. The fact that those of us who remain or are attracted to the field are going to be judged on the basis of whether or not our students are performing up to grade level is not an incentive to stay in this field. In closing, NCLB ignores the fundamental ideas and premises of IDEA. I'm asking you today to remember the students that I teach every day, to remember the Sarahs and the students who are at risk of dropping out. Those students need guidance, they need examples, they need directions. I know in my heart that NCLB is not giving them the directions that they need and the guidance that is necessary. NCLB is not an example of what true education is all about. Today I'm asking for legislation that advocates for policies that protect and strengthen educational rights and opportunities. I thank you for your time this morning, and God bless you all.
Thank you, Ms. Miller-Selner. Questions? Committee. Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you all for your testimony. And I just a, a comment or a question maybe that you might be able to respond to. Excuse me. And Ms. Selner, you mentioned in your testimony that you had some students in your high school class that were in danger of not graduating because they were not able to pass the basic skill testing, that they were not reading at third grade level. And I'm just wondering how they could do any high school work if they're unable to read at a third grade level. And if so, should they be graduating from high school if they cannot read, if they cannot read to a test that measures a third grade performance, if that's what it does, how would they be able to do any of the work that the high school curriculum would require? And what's the way to change that? Wouldn't it be the intent to say if you have students that are in high school that are reading at third grade level that maybe all they should be focused on is getting that reading skill to a point where they could then apply themselves to other curriculum? Any comment on that issue?
Mr. Chair, Senator, if I may, those two different scenarios. Sarah was actually a general education student who did not qualify in special education, and she could not graduate because she had not passed the BSTs. Under the special education law right now with IDEA, if our team committee, if the committee as a whole, parents, general ed students, administration, counselors, plus the student and whole IEP team, so decides that after they've taken the BSTs or the MCAs significant every year up till their senior year, you can pass them individually according to their IEP. So these students can pass. But I think it's important to realize that just because a student has a reading disability or a math disability, that or test anxiety or ADHD doesn't mean that they're not brilliant in other areas of our society. Whoopi Goldberg, John F. Kennedy all had learning disabilities. I think that's really important that you understand that. There's a whole child there. And when I talk about kids at risk of dropping out, trying to keep them there in school because school is their only constant. I have students text messaging me through the summer. Hey, Mrs. Selner, well, it was Mrs. Miller at the time, did you get married yet? The relationship that we have as teachers have with our kids is just amazing. And that keeps them in school. But when we start throwing these tests at them and they get frustrated, oh, I have to have 7 masks, you're kidding. Yeah, you have to have 7 masks. Let's get this done. You can do it. Because there is light at the end of that tunnel. We need to have them be functional in society. If they don't be functional with me, they're going to be on the streets. That's where they're going to be at.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for anybody that can answer this, I think you do bring a lot of good points. I've been arguing against a lot of things with NCLB over the last couple of years. The one thing I think we kind of need to clarify, and I hear this over and over again, that we're teaching to a test. And from my perspective, that's not always a bad thing. And let me clarify. And I'm in the service industry, and I actually carry 3 different licenses, maybe more than that. I keep forgetting how many licenses I carry. But I have to constantly go back to continuing education. And you have to pass a test. So whether you're continuing on in college or you're just in more of a service industry type of thing, a lot of times you're licensed and you have to pass a test. And so I think sometimes there's value to that, so I really need some help in qualifying where, and I think as well Representative McCullough, because where do we, what is good to teach to a test and what isn't, so that we kind of know.
Mr. Chair and Senator, if I could begin to address that. We're not opposed to assessments. But these assessments are not diagnostic. They do not help the teacher adjust and monitor what they're doing in the classroom. They don't help the student. We're not measuring the same student group against each other. We're measuring one group of third graders, and then we have a whole new cohort, and then another group comes in. So it's not so much that it's the test, but we also are asking the wrong questions about the test. But by definition, special education, English language learners, are not at proficient grade level. So to say that they have to be there, otherwise your school is going to be labeled not making adequate yearly progress, is a misnomer. And that's what happens is parents and community members open up the paper, and they want to see, did their school make it or not? They don't look at the details. They just look to find their school and their school district. That's the problem. It's a snapshot on a single day. So we need multiple measures and different assessments to do that. And if we have that, then it's going to be fine, because testing is, in and of itself, is not a bad thing. It's just this type of testing.
Yeah. Follow-up, Sir Jungbaugh.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And a great answer, because I do think we need to separate some of these things out, but I think that is key as we move forward to be able to identify, you know, how do we classify it, what are good tests, how do we figure in some of the diagnostics so we know where we're going. I mean, we need all the tools that teachers can get to move their classes forward, whether they're English language, whether they're ADD or just standard students, if you will.
Right.
I think we've always needed to separate that out. But, sitting through the committees over the past 5 years, I don't think anybody's really come forward and said, here's our ideas on how we do that so we can incorporate it into legislation, whether it's federal or state, to help us, know where to change directions.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator, we'd be happy to sit down and talk about that.
Good.
Okay, Senator Hatt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe a question or a follow-up to the comment that Mr. Duer made and Senator Jungbauer, just to clarify the testing. My recollection or understanding of what No Child Left Behind was trying to do was after some 30 or 40 years of federal education aid, that there was an attempt to say we need to quantify how effective that aid has been in producing a better school or education system. That it wasn't, in my recollection, the testing wasn't designed to be diagnostic for purposes of maybe improving the education of individual students. In fact, when I was on the school board, we were not even permitted to know what the tests were, what individual students, how they performed individually. We were looking at what was the testing and how it gave us an indication of how well the third grade or the fifth grade or math so I guess my question is there value to that? If we say there are two ways that you can test individuals in an education setting with the intent of helping that individual become more proficient at whatever skill is being tested, but there's also another way to test, which is as an accountability measure, if the federal government is going to put money into a structure and say we want the structure to perform better, how are we going to evaluate that performance? And then you look at how that system performs. And it was my understanding that No Child Left Behind was an attempt to try to put together a system that would assess that. And what I sometimes get concerned about is that there seems to be no acknowledgement that there may be two different types of testing that we're trying to do here, and that if we say that all testing is just for the assessment of individuals and their performance and as a diagnostic tool, then I think that you're right. No Child Left Behind probably doesn't fit that role. But it's been my understanding that that wasn't the purpose of No Child Left Behind, but it was more for how well does this system do in, for example, taking newly arrived immigrants who may not have English skills, and how well does it do in getting those students to a proficient level of English? And it may be that the expectation that you should do it in 2 years isn't right, but we should know how well a system can take a student who knows nothing of English and get them to a point where they can be proficient. And so and don't misunderstand, I'm not a big fan of No Child Left Behind. In fact, one of my questions I hope we can get to is what people think the federal role for education ought to be. But we have had, for years and years, lots of money going into education from the federal sector, and I think that after some period of time there was a thought that we should try to gauge how well this money is being spent, what we are getting for that expenditure. So maybe if you'd like to comment on that, any of you, about is there a difference in this kind of testing, and if so, if the No Child Left Behind testing isn't designed to be diagnostic but more as an assessment of the system, how does it do on that score, and how could it be done better to say how well do the schools as a system perform rather than just how well do individual students perform?
Response.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Senator, there are different kinds of testing, diagnostic and looking at the system itself. But when you are taking the test, we know that children learn at different rates, and we know that English language learners come in with different skills. So to say, are you proficient on a certain day, on a certain time, and then to say that the system is not being there for them is not accurate. And so it is too narrow a focus. And then what happens is you have sanctions because you have special education learners, or you have English language learners, or other. You know, there's 37 ways to not make adequate yearly progress. And there's not a lot of ways to be successful. The number of students that activate a cell just drop down to 20, and that's why you see more schools not making adequate yearly progress. Parents and teachers don't make the connection because of what they're seeing in their classroom and what they're seeing with their student and the relationship that they have. They are seeing progress. And so what we need to have is a growth model incorporated into that to check the system, not the proficiency on this day, this is what's happening. So I think you can incorporate that in a growth model system.
Okay. We'll take one more question, and that'll be Senator Saltzman. If it's a question.
It is a question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. We heard earlier from parents who talked about the cuts that are being done in the fine arts. What are your thoughts in the sense that making sure that our earliest learners are proficient in reading by third grade and the importance of that? Where does that sit with the fact that school districts are putting more and more into what I would call elective courses, Mandarin Chinese for first graders, other sorts of things, when if these kids don't read, we're going to find that Ms. Sellner is going to see children in high school who are not special ed students, who are not, you know, being categorized as special ed or labeled, still don't have the third grade reading skills. Any thoughts on that, or is that too hot of a topic to address?
Well, in other words, kind of a hot topic. But.
Well, what I heard this last week is I sat and watched superintendents as they talked about putting more emphasis on reading, the importance of that. And I heard from several superintendents last week of the very the thoughtful question of what are we going to give up to make that happen in our earliest grades? Is that something that we need to be looking at in terms of really being, able to address achievement?
Mr. Chair and Senator, what we know about learning and what we know about students is they have multiple ways of learning, multiple intelligences, and that disciplines are actually interconnected. So just to focus on one area, you can learn reading in a music class. You can learn math in a music class. You can learn different structures of language in a Mandarin Chinese class. So, but what we know is that you need a foundation, pre-K, and Art Rolnick from the Federal Reserve has done the studies and says the return on investment is double digit when you do that. So there are multiple ways to teach reading, but we know that kids have to have reading skills down by the time they get to third grade because they are learning to read, and then from that point on, then they are reading to learn. And so once we have those skills, and that's why we're making draconian cuts in areas simply because we have to focus on it. I get calls from first grade teachers that are crying, like Robin was saying, because they're doing assessments in the first couple days of school. They don't even know their kids. The kids don't even understand school yet, and we're doing assessments on those. So we need to take the whole child into account when we do this, and that we have to have a rich, broad curriculum in order to reach the whole child.
Congresswoman,
just to follow up just really quickly, and is there evidence-based research to support that?
Yes, there is.
That music and all these other programs are more important than additional times in reading.
I don't know that it's more important, but it's as important.
Okay, I'd like to see that information. Okay. That would be very helpful as we look at our, resources.
We can get you that.
Thank you, Congresswoman McCollum.
I just wanted to reinforce some of the things that have been said here by everyone. First, the Minnesota delegation, by and large, did not vote to support No Child Left Behind, because when I was on the Education Policy Committee, I remember the days that Commissioner Segrin and I spent over at the House on K-12 really trying to do diagnostic testing, directing resources towards those diagnostics for schools that were struggling to meet an achievement gap, because Alex and I didn't want to leave any child behind, and neither did anybody else in the room then or now. The growth model, the adequate yearly progress. Just for the record, adequate yearly progress means one thing in Minnesota, and it means something different in Wisconsin. It means something different in North Dakota. So to your point, what are we measuring? We're not measuring anything nationally. We're measuring zip nationally. We have all this information that we've been collecting, and when I asked Secretary Spellings, what does it mean? She can't get a report back to me. So what we set up nationally, and the reason why the Minnesota delegation didn't vote for it, is we got it. We knew this was, to quote President Bush, hard work. It's very hard work. We knew we had made mistakes in Minnesota moving forward. Remember the group of students that had the special ceremony with Governor Ventura up in his office because testing wasn't even scored right? So we knew there were a lot of challenges, and this broad sweeping brush was, one, not measuring anything, and two, the federal government is about 10% of your education.
Seven.
Seven to ten. It's different in different states. I'm doing it. It's about 7% in Minnesota, 10% nationally.
Yes.
Leave No Child Behind, which was supposed to be funded to pay for these tests. That was the other thing. I said, show me the money. It's $55 billion underfunded. And this year, when the president submitted his budget, it was a $2 billion increase that the House asked for Leave No Child Behind. The president's budget had flatlined. The president had cut Head Start. We increased Head Start. And this education bill, funding bill, is under threat of veto because we are, quote unquote, spending too much money. If I could make one more comment. Your point to ESL, Mr. Mattson, is it? Mattson? Mm-hmm. You said your students are being tested at 1 year?
Yeah. Over that 1 year or more.
Most states have applied for waivers and have been granted waivers for English as second language students to go to at 2 years. That's one of the things that they're looking in the test. But, you know, that in of itself is not across the board even. When we do have children coming at different ages from refugees camps versus children in other parts of the United States where the majority of the school might have English as a second language but all Spanish as a first language and not coming from those types of situations. So I think Minnesota, whether it's cell size, ESL, and changing growth models with the inability to apply for a growth model with changing the testing, here, I think this is why I'm here, because as things move forward, we need better coordination, and we need to better understand here what other states are doing, because, one, everybody gets to set their own tests. Some school districts in some states set their own tests. How's that for measuring something nationally? And then, secondly, the waivers, with the different waivers out there by different states. Are we comparing ourselves to on top of that? So those are some of the things I just wanted to clear up. Some are state issues, some are federal issues. I got enough of a mess at the federal level. So.
Well, and that's the problem with this whole law, is that it's a moving target that is constantly changing, and so it's hard to prepare students for that when you don't know what the criterion, and it keeps changing on you.
Teachers, you did an outstanding job on behalf of your thousands of colleagues throughout the state, and we realize you're up front in the firing line, and you know, the stress, the compassion that you shared here is felt by all of us, and we'll make an impact. We commend those recommendations, and the key for us now is taking those recommendations and doing some follow-up to make it meaningful. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
We next have three testifiers representing superintendents. They could please approach. Welcome. Please proceed.
Good morning, Senator Wieger, Congressman McCollum, members of the committee. We're representing the Minnesota Association of School Administrators and the superintendents in Minnesota. And what we probably could really just get up here and say is just ditto, and then we could go sit down and save you all the time. But a lot of what we want to say, I think, has been said. But we'll try to say it again anyway, and we'll try to do it relatively briefly. I'm going to make very, very brief remarks and turn it over to Tom Westerhaus, who's superintendent at Prior Lake Savage, and Kathy Leadham, who is the superintendent in Willmar. And in my very brief remarks, I'm going to pick up on something that Senator Salzman said earlier, and she kind of made this comment, this analogy that's always been used about for people who don't like testing or don't like the large state-level or NCLB testing. They say you can't fatten cattle just by weighing them. And I can tell you that that may not have been true many years ago, or maybe you didn't weigh them many years ago, but today you weigh them. And I have a very good friend of mine who raises thousands of beef cattle out in central Minnesota. He raises them from calves to beef to go to market. And I'm going to tell you that he weighs them all the time. And he weighs the younger cattle biweekly. And he measures them every 2 weeks to see how much they've grown. He does it very quickly. And he adjusts the feed formulas every single 2 weeks to make sure that he's getting maximum growth. I'll just say that teachers and administrators, by and large, actually love testing. They love testing. They love it when it measures growth. They love it when it's done quickly. They love it when it gives them information that they can use to monitor what's going on in a classroom. The point I'm making is that NCLB does testing backwards. Plus, it's punitive. The testing is very tightly controlled from the top levels. It's a top-down system. It is not frequent. It doesn't measure growth. It doesn't give timely results. And frankly, it's very inefficient in terms of both time and money. In a word, the NCLB testing program, as it's been conceived, should be scrapped and replaced by a simple, practical system as close to the teacher as possible. So that's my very brief testimony, and I'll turn it over to Superintendent Westerhaus.
Thank you, Charlie. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. First of all, thank you for taking this time to listen to the issues regarding No Child Left Behind. I think that's absolutely essential. I've been asked to speak on the impact on local districts, in particular my district. I'm superintendent of the Prior Lake Savage Schools, as Charlie said, which is a 7,000 student school district, suburban school district. I'm also currently president of the MASA organization, so I hear from lots of superintendents throughout the state. First of all, No Child Left Behind, we're hearing all of the faults and the problems. It definitely has had a positive impact on our district in that I really believe we are now making better decisions at analyzing data. I truly believe that that's something that maybe we in education have not been as strong at in the past, and I think it's forcing us to look at data in with eyes that we have not done in the past. A simple example, a recent example was one of our six elementary schools had outstanding results for a third grade level. All of our third grade classrooms, I believe six third grade classrooms in a particular school and the MCA2's testing. And our teachers and administrators from the other schools took time to look at that data and spend time with those teachers. What's being done right in that particular school? To bring the successful results that they were having with reading. That's a perfect example of use of the data in a positive way. That was at our Westwood Elementary School, and so we are able to now replicate that throughout our district, and it's making good changes. But that's where I'll stop on the successes of No Child Left Behind in my comments today. I think there's been many challenges and difficulties in implementing No Child Left Behind in school districts, And here are a few of our school district challenges. Labeling of schools and districts not meeting adequate yearly progress has had tremendously negative impact on our community and school district. I am repeatedly asked about our failing schools in the Prior Lake Savage district, when in actuality 3% of our students did not make adequate yearly progress this year. Those student groups were the small cell sizes of in our district, in particular our free and reduced lunch population, our black student population, and our special education population. The other 97% of our students are performing well on every other indicator that I can find, from ACT scores, advanced placement scores, MCA2s, the NWEA's MAP testing, graduation rates, and on and on. But that's not what I get asked about. I get asked about our failing schools. And of course, we are concerned about our subgroups and students not making that. 3% is just as important to me as the 93% students. And so we're making every effort to address the needs of those students. However, revenues are not there to hire the kinds of folks that we need to hire to do that. Basic skills specialists, reading and math folks. Senator Saltzman mentioned the response to intervention program that we're trying to implement in our district as well. That's a prevention to becoming part of the failing students as we move along in the system. Another issue that's specific to our district, but I think applies in other districts, is addressing subgroups can be difficult with groups like free and reduced lunch populations. I know who the students are, but I cannot release that information to our teachers and principals about who the actual students are that are not meeting adequate yearly progress. So it's sort of a catch-22. They need help, but I can't tell them who the students are. They just need to help all the students. So those are some of the mechanics that occur within the trying to implement in the school district. Because we are in the second year of not making AYP as a district for special education students, this was another thing that came to light for us this year. We are required to use Title I revenues. Our district has very little Title I revenues, very needed in some of our schools, but the dollars are limited. Well, even with those limited resources, we are now asked to take some of the already limited resources and place that into professional development training for our staff to deal with all the other kids. So we'll have less Title I revenues as a result of not meeting AYP through No Child Left Behind. And these are students that are already two grade levels behind. I attended the same session that Senator Saltzman attended last week, and they've indicated to us that, you know, if you don't get them less than 2 years behind before you try to reverse kids, you're going to struggle forever. The odds of being able to bring them up when they're 2 years behind, even in the primary grades, is pretty tough. So those are the students in the primary grades that we're trying to address. We need to take dollars away from our students and actually cut hours from our people that are working with Title I in order to put it into staff development dollars. That's kind of a sham in Minnesota when we already have a good system in place for designating staff development dollars for training already. And so the dollars are there, but we needed to put more into them. Another difficulty of implementing No Child Left Behind is the inordinate amount of testing. You've heard that already this morning, occurring in districts, including the time, squeeze on time and financial resources. The mechanics of the testing process are pretty incredible, and the impacts are pretty dramatic. That same school that I mentioned to you with an outstanding reading program was cited this year for not making adequate yearly progress due to an error in sending results of gifted students back to the Minnesota Department of Education in the wrong envelope. We're still waiting to hear whether or not our appeal for that school would take them off the list, because those tests have been scored and it would actually take us off the list for that particular school. But meanwhile, the feathers are out of the pillow and trying to get our parents of that particular school to understand that they're not in a failing school, and because the mechanics of the testing process put such time pressures and crunches on our schools getting the results back that an error was made. Not a pleasing error, but an error nonetheless. We have no revenues to hire assessment folks to analyze the data, handling of the mechanics of the testing, let alone that advanced data management, data and trend analysis, measurement of growth and progress over time. We want to take that data and use it for making better decisions about our students, but it's not able to be done. The assessment functions have currently been added onto the backs of staff members who are already overwhelmed with providing the quality programs for their students. In Minnesota, we also had the late arrival of data from the state this year. That made implementation of AYP changes very difficult. The delays in when districts received the MCA and AYP results pushed the handling of data back to right before school began. It resulted in little time for districts and building leadership to analyze that data and make decisions about this year, which is the year that we need to make our changes. But we're making it, but now at the expense of pulling teachers out of their classrooms where they need to be to help those kids make decisions about how we're going to change our instruction and programs for those particular students. So it's kind of a catch-22 there as well. The testing process is also becoming more and more difficult in that we're short rooms and spaces for actual testing. We need special rooms for special education students, 504 students, ELL students, students who need accommodations in reading, math, or both. In addition, the shift to computerized testing overtaxes the technology and personnel available. Sounded like a good concept, but it's not working on the receiver's end. It stretched out the testing season, which is already enormous, and tied up computers for regular instruction. Lastly, I'm fearful that my district and others like ours are beginning to focus resources. I heard the question earlier. I think it's starting to happen. Focus resources on student subgroups, not making AYP at the expense of other students, gifted students, and average students who make up the majority of our student population. With limited resources and the media and state focus on failing schools, districts will undoubtedly sacrifice class size, as we've done in my district. Things like international baccalaureate programs, gifted academies, career and vocational training, world language initiatives, fine arts initiatives, advanced placement programs, and the like to raise test scores of our struggling students in order to avoid headlines like I had this summer. Quote, some schools miss progress report. State AYP report fails schools for subgroups performance. And I need to respond to that to our public. Now, that'll have long-term impact on the true success or failure of my otherwise outstanding school district. So in summary, No Child Left Behind has added attention to purposeful analysis of data on student achievement to school districts in order for all students to succeed. I believe in its premises, especially the all students' success. However, as with so much in education, the pendulum seems to swing too far one way or the other. The overfocus on labeling of truly outstanding schools and districts as failing or not meeting AYP due to lack of progress for small subgroups is a direct attack, in my opinion, on public education that may never recover in the public's eyes in my lifetime. It appears to be only a matter of time before all districts and schools fail.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Superintendent, just three questions for me to help put this in perspective. Three numbers. Your free and reduced, what percentage?
About 8%.
How about special ed?
Special ed is about 10%.
And then your cross subsidy for special ed, do you have a ballpark?
I would say we're receiving, percentage-wise, we receive about 59% in the cross-subsidy. Completing my comments, one last comment. If we as a state really want to become world-class schools, world-class state, which I think is the Minnesota promise that we as superintendents really believe in, which is rigor for all, I think we need to provide resources for the teaching, remediation, enrichment programs that are needed. And I think we need to look at an assessment program that is manageable, realistic, and useful for obtaining necessary data about students to make curricular and instructional changes at the local level without the trappings and bureaucracy associated with the current testing requirement. So thank you for the time.
Thank you.
Representative McCollum, Senator Wieger, and members of the committee, we're very pleased to be here and speak on behalf of the superintendents in the state of Minnesota. I would agree with Tom's commentary about one of the benefits of No Child Left Behind is certainly the utilization of data to drive decision making. Not that there aren't other avenues available for doing that, but certainly that has probably forged us ahead in that arena. In addition, I think that the requirement and I guess the call to action to have high expectations for all of our students and all of our learners has certainly been a benefit as well. But nevertheless, this is a complex and punitive plan that negatively singles out struggling subgroups, as you have heard repeatedly this morning. There are penalties for the sites that have the greatest needs rather than assistance. Countless dollars are going into funding a very problematic plan and a problematic federal law. We need funding instead for before school and after school programming. We need funding for transportation for that before school and after school programming rather than funding that is used to carry out a federal law that is filled with problems and filled with holes. We need assistance for families who are struggling to meet basic needs. When a subgroup is underperforming, resources should flow to assist them with the issues at hand rather than to carrying out the bureaucratic aspects of this law. You've heard again this morning that the tests have no relevance really for teaching and learning. The energy goes into teaching to the tests, and you've heard educators testify to that prior to our being here at the podium. We need a growth model for testing that provides feedback on learning progress of each individual learner. And because districts need that, many districts, like Wilmer, we double test. We not only do the state test, the MCAs, but we are using a growth model, the NWEA tests, in order to provide the feedback that our teachers know in order to make proper teaching and learning decisions. Formative assessments are really what impact teaching and learning, and that seems to be the direction that our teachers are yearning for if they're going to get the feedback that's necessary in order to optimize their teaching and learning time. If NCLB is measuring the impact of the federal investment in education, then a national test should really be used for that purpose rather than 50 individual states all coming up with their own assessments. There really is no national comparison that can result if that indeed is one of the things that we're trying to get at regarding the taxpayers' investment in education from a federal level. We really need a very focused approach on improvement planning. If we're going to make improvement plans that are going to be worthwhile, we have to drill down into the test data and find out exactly who has not mastered what and then target those needs very deliberately. Currently, we have general building or general district improvement plans that really take focus away from the learners all along the learning continuum. And that is one of the things we fear the most, is that we'll be targeting so much specific remediation, and then as we look at a building plan or a district plan, we somehow lose sight of all of the other learners that are represented on the learning continuum. So we have to also, under these circumstances, as superintendents and other leaders, we have to work very, very hard within our districts to avoid finger-pointing towards underperforming subgroups. You've heard about some of the headlines. I think that's typical of what happens when a district is found not to be making adequate yearly progress or a building is not making adequate yearly progress. All of a sudden, people are looking at the subgroups in a less than advantageous way. So we really have to avoid plans that focus on all students, some of whom do not need remediation. I think that's a key point as well, that some of these plans are much more overarching in nature, and we may be taking away from some of the opportunities for some of our learners. There are countless dollars that are going into carrying out this federal law. Certainly our own Minnesota Department of Education is saddled with implementing the law. Think of the assessment costs. Think of all of the staff energy that goes into carrying out the federal legislation. And certainly I commend them on all of the effort that they've put into this because they also are charged with carrying out this federal mandate. But again, funds are going into directions that many of us would feel are less than applicable to the needs at hand. We've heard about the diversion of Title I funds that really ultimately hurts the students who need the Title I or Title III assistance the most. Money is going towards improvement planning, and some of this should be channeled to individual and small group intensive assistance, as well as meeting the basic needs of so many of our learners. Funds should really go for extended English language learner programs, newcomer centers, kindergarten and preschool programs that help to close the achievement gap for children that are living in poverty, rather than having a punitive approach after the fact. It takes time to learn day-to-day basic English communication and language skills. It takes years to acquire the English language vocabulary that's necessary in order to learn and succeed in areas like math, science, and the language arts. So, by and large, we're looking at a federal law that's punitive in nature that needs major reform and major restructuring if indeed it is going to succeed or to be in existence at all. We really thank you for taking the time to seek this type of broad-based input and dealing with a very complex federal education issue that obviously needs major repair. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a couple of questions, maybe just to, again, to fill in as Senator Olsen was trying to do some data for us, but maybe each of the superintendents, could you tell us how much money, how much federal money under the ESEA, the Elementary Secondary Education Act, that your district receives? What are the dollars that your district receives under the Education Act, the federal act?
I don't have the total dollar amount in my head, but we have a pie chart that we're sharing with our referendum committees, and our district receives 8% of all of our district revenues from the federal government.
And
that would be all federal dollars.
So, Mr. Chairman, so that would include more than just the federal money from the that would come under the ESEA umbrella?
I believe that's pretty much it. I'm talking in general fund, in the general fund area, because you have food service and other funds. So I would say that's probably all ESEA dollars.
And, Mr. Chairman and Superintendent, 8% would then be approximately how much?
Well, we have a $55 million federal general fund budget.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Leadham, do you have any idea what your federal funding is?
I don't have those figures with me, but basically we get just under $1 million that would be utilized for our various title programs and other federal education type programs that are in existence for our learners. Title I, Title II, and Title III certainly are very focused towards the issues that we're talking about here today.
And thank you. And Mr. Chairman, just again, going back to the comment I was making in the last set of testifiers, that my understanding of the federal education involvement was premised on the idea that there is inequity in education in the United States that is demographically based, I guess, that some groups of students perform relatively well and others do not. And so back in the mid-60s, 40-some years ago, there was an effort to fund targeted funding to school districts around the country to improve what we've now called the achievement gap. And so my question is, over the years, as your districts have received this federal money, how have you done in achieving that goal, and then how is that to be assessed? And I understand very clearly that you're not happy with the current regimen, and I'm not either, frankly, but if that's the goal, is to have federal money funding that reduction of achievement or the disparity in achievement between my white students and non-white students, if that's the proper distinction to make, it may not be. But if that's the goal, how do we assess that if this is not the right way to do it? And how has that money that you've gotten achieved that or helped to achieve that? Have you seen success? Has it been a useful exercise? Or should we just close down the whole operation at all? I mean, you talk about the objective is to see a national, maybe we need national testing, and I think there's a host of issues with that. And so part of my question is this federal involvement in education at the state level just entirely based on a premise that isn't doable?
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, obviously the federal investment in education is very small in the overall scheme of things. But I would maintain that we have had excellent Title I programs, for instance, and Title III programs that have helped struggling learners to, in many cases, exit from that special assistance that they've needed at, you know, during various times in their educational career. But again, I go back to the fact that it's very difficult for some of our learners to focus on learning when their basic needs are not being met. It's Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If you're, you know, struggling to have food in your stomach and a place to sleep at night, then learning, which is higher on that hierarchy of needs, is just not going to be as much in the forefront. In fact, for our district, we've now incorporated a vision that talks about every student understanding that education adds value to life. While all of us in this room probably understand that, there are many of our learners and many of our families that do not have that value for education because they've never experienced personally that education has added value to their life or that things have changed around in any way because of education. It just isn't high on their priority list. They're looking for ways to meet their basic needs. So I think we need a more comprehensive approach towards dealing with our children. I mentioned the concerted effort that's necessary for English language learners. Also, we've heard this morning about our preschool investment and how critical that is to close the achievement gap early on.
I'd like to thank the superintendents, and we may have a chance to recall some witnesses. I'd like to also let you know the rest of the meeting plans. Congresswoman McCollum needs to leave for Washington no later than 12:30. We also have some other accommodations to make for presenters. We'll next hear from Senator Kelly, former senator, whose fingerprints are all over most of what we're talking about and different ways, and his work at the Humphrey Institute as well. Following Senator Kelly, we will hear from reps of different organizations. We'll ask them to join us at the table again, perhaps going 3 or 4 minutes apiece. One citizen asked to testify, Kim Miller. We'll include her. And then we're going to ask this Commissioner of Education to link a lot of what's been said to activities of the department as well, and then hopefully have a chance for some more dialogue amongst us. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, Congresswoman McCollum, members of the committee, thank you for the invitation to be here. My name is Steve Kelly, and I'm the director of the Center for Science, Technology, and Public Policy at the Humphrey Institute of the University of Minnesota. And I appreciate the chair's accommodation. I'm teaching a class this afternoon, and I figure I ought to make sure I'm ready for it. But I wanted to tell a story from the reading I assigned for today. Back in the late 1700s in Germany, the folks who were managing German forests decided that they would take advantage of the latest learning about scientific forestry management. And their goal was to maximize the quantity of wood produced and therefore the revenue available to the German government from the management of those forests. So they focused in on quantity of wood produced, the volume of wood produced. And they because that was their measuring stick, they changed the forests in Germany. They planted trees in rows. They planted all Norway spruce. And that plan worked out really well in the first generation. The volume of wood produced, and therefore the revenue, went up dramatically. In the second generation, some 80 years after they started this experiment, the quantity of wood produced fell off catastrophically because the forest was no longer protected by a diversity of species who were eating the pests, who were protecting the trees from insects. The trees lined up in rows, all the same species, more subject to disease, more subject to storm damage, a failure that they didn't recognize until they were in the second generation. And it just gets worse because the soil fertility falls off from lack of diversity. So they had picked a scientific method of measuring what they wanted to get to without recognizing the complexity of the system that they were dealing with. I think the fundamental problem with No Child Left Behind is that we are narrowing in on one measure and not respecting the diversity of the system that we're trying to deal with. And that goes to Senator Hand's question about what's the problem with measuring or teaching to the test. If you are narrowing your vision of what constitutes education so much that that's all you're talking about, you're going to do irreparable damage to the broader system of education and to the ultimate goal that you want. So for a period of time, we may get some improvement in results, because what happened was that that first generation of scientifically managed forest was building off, could parasitize the fertility in the soil that had been built up over previous generations. And our teachers, who are trying to get these results in this test, as we cut resources to science, arts, music, physical education, we're acting like parasites on this broader system that we had built up. And we're narrowing in on this one set of test results in math and reading that are really very basic skills. So I think that's the fundamental problem with No Child Left Behind. Then there are a range of other things that we can talk about. Fortunately, the House draft of revisions to No Child Left Behind reflects their appreciation of that narrowness of the focus of the existing bill. They propose to let states use diverse assessments, including tests in different subject matter like history, science, civics, and so forth. I think that's a positive thing, but they can only use that, those diverse assessments, for in elementary school, 15% of the new proposed annual measurable objectives. So the narrow tests are still six times as important as all those other things. And in high school, they could use it for 25%. In high school, those other subjects are still math and reading, that single test, is still three times as important as the other subjects. The new proposal also calls for using a growth model. But again, it's so complex that we're staying focused on one set of measures, these tests, that it's hard to see how it'll work. Now, the other good news in that bill is that there are some incentives for states to adopt a broader set of standards, and that broader set of standards is college and work readiness. And I'd urge the committee to focus its attention on that, and because I think one of the challenges is that Congress has a split personality about this. They want to, as Senator Hand was suggesting, they want to do something about accountability for spending under Title I for low-income kids. But at the same time, they recognize that we actually need to pay attention to a broader measure, and that is how many of our kids are graduating from college, some kind of college. Now, to change that number, we have to have more of our students graduating from high school ready to go on to college. So they recognize that that's a goal, but it is not incorporated into what we're measuring. And so that's my concern, is that we're focusing on a narrow set of skills and not paying sufficient attention to this broader set of goals that at least this new proposal starts to hint at. And so I think the committee ought to pay attention to that. The other aspect of this split personality in the Congress is they also recognize the importance of science, technology, engineering, and math education, but we aren't measuring that either. And so on the indicators that what gets measured gets done, Congress, even though it's talking about some good things, isn't talking about measuring the right things. The other problem with No Child Left Behind that comes through from the testimony that you've heard before is that we're trying to use this very narrow measure for problems associated with three different groups of kids. Kids who have challenges because of socioeconomic background, kids who have special education needs, and kids who are English language learners. And the bill, the law, even the new proposal, tends to treat all three groups as if the causes are similar and the solutions are similar. The sanctions imposed or the remedies are the same for a failure with a subgroup in all three categories, when the causes might be completely different. And so I think there's a failure to recognize that, both in the existing law and the proposals for reform. So I do think there ought to be an accountability system, but I don't think that the federal government ought to be reaching around state government into our school classrooms and holding individual classrooms accountable for their results. I think that the federal government ought to hold the state accountable for our success in preparing all of our kids to be ready to be successful in college. And that'll take us a long time to do. I don't think we can get it done by 2014, but I do think that our teachers recognize the need to do that, our administrators recognize that, and I have a feeling that all of you would like to see our state achieve broader goals than the ones that are focused on in No Child Left Behind.
Thank you, Senator Kelly. Questions? Senator Torres, right?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now I don't know the protocol because apparently a senator will be always a senator, so I have to say Senator Kelly. Thank you for your report, Senator. I would like to ask you a question with respect to an issue that really concerns me, and that is the trend that I see as I talk about achievement gap in the state of Minnesota and the relationship to testing. It is my understanding that private schools, and not all the schools, actually combine tests to send information so that we will be able to really have a broad picture of who are the children and what do the results actually show with respect to achievement. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Torres-Ray, private schools are not subject to the mandatory testing requirements of No Child Left Behind. Now, that doesn't mean that private schools don't engage in using standardized tests for some purposes, but they aren't subject to the reporting requirements of No Child Left Behind. So we cannot know how they compare on those same measures to the students in public schools. Charter school students, though, because charter schools are public schools, are subject to the No Child Left Behind testing requirements and that system of accountability.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the trends that we see certainly are trends that reflect the testing of certain populations. And what I see then is that as we analyze, and now we are more able, as the superintendent said, to really understand statistically the trends, more and more that we see that some of the problems affect certain children. As I see the correlation between achievement gap and child poverty, I am really concerned about who are we testing, and I think one of our superintendents says something very, very important in my view. And she said, we are leaving the most vulnerable children behind because we are using data that really does not help us look at how do we use the results. So we have data, we can understand data, but we don't have the resources to do anything about it. That is really like hiring somebody to look at the roof and understand that, you know, we have a problem with the roof, but then I don't have money to change it. Then I use the $500 that I may have to hire somebody to go up there to confirm that I have a problem. And that person will tell me that I need to change the roof and I don't have $5,000 or $7,000 or $10,000, whatever it is that I need to change the roof. So what is the use of these testing? Is it going to help us really, really deliver the message? I think Congressman McCollum said something very important. We need $55 billion to do this work. What is the use of testing and these results and this analysis and becoming more and more knowledgeable about what the problem is if we don't have the resources to address it? And that is impacting the most vulnerable children in this country, and in particular in the state of Minnesota. I am alarmed about these statistics and children of color in the state of Minnesota. We are not making a difference, and this testing is not helping.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Torres-Ray, your question and comments raise a number of points. I know the chair's got a time limit, so I'll try to be really succinct in responding to them. One is I do think that the concept of separating testing results into different categories, subgroups, is a useful concept. Minnesota had started down that path before No Child Left Behind was adopted. So I think that's important. We do need to know how different categories of students are performing. So that's a valuable asset to the statistics. It is valuable to know because I have seen over the time period that I've had a chance to visit with at schools and pay attention to the results that teachers and administrators are using standardized tests, not necessarily the MCAs, but other standardized tests, to adjust what they're doing in order to try to improve student achievement for all kids, even though they're not getting what I think are essential additional resources. So it is a good thing that, teachers and schools are responding to what they're learning, even with existing resources. I totally agree with you that we need additional resources. It's I think Congresswoman McCollum had a good point about No Child Left Behind, but I would put just as much emphasis on the underfunding of the Individuals with Disability Education Act, because that's a national commitment to an important civil right for kids with disabilities, and it shouldn't fall just on state governments or on local school districts to raise the funding to comply with that mandate. And then I also want to make one last point about the use of statistics. I wouldn't stop doing testing, but given the changes in demographics, if we're going to meet our needs for more engineers and more scientists in this country, then we have to graduate from high school and graduate from college more African-American and Latino students who are prepared for and actually interested in the math and the sciences. And one of the things I'm most concerned about as we talk about adding rigor to the system of preparation is that we're not paying attention to what to do, to how to engage African-American kids and Latino kids in the math and sciences to make it cool for them to be, to think about being scientists or mathematicians in the future. I can think of ways that we could prepare them that would actually turn kids off to wanting to do that, and I think we have to pay attention to both the preparation and the level of excitement or engagement that all of our kids, regardless of socioeconomic or ethnic background, are getting in our public schools. And that's another thing that concerns me about No Child Left Behind is we're not paying attention to that sense of engagement as we pay attention to the narrow set of statistics that the law produces.
Senator Kelly, thank you for your thoughtful comments and continued service.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you.
We'll have the next four testifiers representing different groups. If they could please approach and limit their comments to 3 minutes apiece. And they'll be followed by Citizen Kim Miller, who will speak for 2 minutes, and then we'll hear from Commissioner Segrin. Welcome. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. AMSD represents 33 school districts in the Seven County metropolitan area. Appreciate very much the opportunity to offer a few comments, and I will try to be brief. If you talk to our superintendents and school board members, you'll get a variety of opinions, but I think almost universally they will echo what you've heard earlier, and that is that NCLB does need major overhaul. Some will probably go as far to say that that the law is unsalvageable and really needs to be repealed and we need to start over. I would zero in on one fundamental flaw, and I think it's been touched on, but it relates to the goal of 100% proficiency. If you haven't read an article titled Proficiency for All, an Oxymoron, it was written by Richard Rothstein at the Economic Policy Institute, along with Rebecca Jacobson and Tamara Wilder, two PhD candidates at Columbia University. But I would highly recommend it. If you go to the Economic Policy Institute website, you'll be able to find the article. But I would just read one passage quickly that I think really gets at the fundamental flaw. And that passage says, "No goal can simultaneously be challenging to and achievable by all students across the entire achievement distribution. A standard can either be a minimal standard, which presents no challenge to typical and advanced students, or it can be a challenging standard, which is unachievable by many students." And that that's the where we find ourselves. And states have struggled with this because there is no definition of proficiency in the statute. We've heard some people say, well, it means grade level. Well, no, that's not what NCLB says. It does not say grade level. And so states have struggled with where to set that bar. And as you all know, different states have set it at different places. I think most of our folks would argue that we should go the direction of setting that bar high. And as following up on what Senator Kelly said, it should be consistent with an achievement level that is going to allow students then to be prepared to enter post-secondary. But again, if you set it there, by definition, it is not going to be attainable by 100% of students. So we need to drop that misguided notion from the law. That doesn't mean that you don't continue to shine the spotlight on results and break it down by different subgroups to show where we're not meeting expectations and to show where we need improvement. But it would allow us then to move away from the punitive consequences and instead focus on building capacity and directing resources and energy to where we need it, to where we need to improve it. And if you just imagine for a moment, if over the last 5 years we had, instead of all the focus we've had on consequences and arguing about what should be the order of consequences, should it be choice, supplemental services, which is first, you know, how do we know if supplemental service providers are going to do the job? What if that energy and resources had been directed toward full-day kindergarten, early childhood learning, summer school, extended time? Where would we be right now? So I'd just leave it at that, Mr. Chairman, members. And thank you, Representative McCollum. I forgot to thank you, too, in my opening. Thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative McCollum, my name is Brad Lundell. I'm the Executive Director of Schools for Equity in Education. We're a consortium of 60 school districts with districts both in the metro and non-metro area. I would just say that I always like to talk about me first. I guess, you know, No Child Left Behind is kind of like my tie. It's kind of messy, it's busy, and if you took a poll of the people in this room, more would probably dislike it than like it. So it's I think that there's a lot to be said about No Child Left Behind that's applicable to that. In my conversations with districts, one of the strongest comments came from the Brainerd School District. Brainerd School District's consistent in the top 1,000 school districts in the country, as measured by Newsweek magazine. They have high ACT scores. One-third of the last 12 AP scholars in the state of Minnesota, four of the last 12 AP scholars, have come from the Brainerd School District. They have a comprehensive curriculum that meets kids with a strong vocational program. They've got a great area learning center, strong special ed program, but yet, because of the No Child Left Behind law, they're looking at grades that make them look like a district that is in need of some big help. I think that that's the problem that I see with No Child Left Behind, is that we have the AYP and these other things. We can talk about the specificity that goes along with the testing and whether or not SPED students should be part of that testing, or whether the way that we're treating the special ed students now is the most appropriate way. But I think that there are issues there, and I think that the problem that we continue to get is this inaccurate picture of districts that look like they're in trouble when really they're actually doing a very, very good job. I think there's a couple of other things, and I think talking about one of the things that No Child Left Behind, I think, has had a subtle effect on, and probably more than subtle, is the kind of dismantling of vocational education throughout the state of Minnesota. Because I think that you see previously students that were probably best treated or best served in those venues are no longer able to get there because of what the stress to get those folks onto the AYP or to get to pass the test scores. And I think that that's also showing, as those programs go away, they also lessen opportunities for children that are passing the tests. I think the other thing is then with, and Senator Saltzman's been a real leader on the response to intervention. I think that's extremely important as we move forward, because I think that keeps more kids out of special education, keeps them in the testing in the regular ed classroom, which will kind of quit, bring an end to this bifurcation, if you will, of the treatment of testing of kids in one to another. And I think, again, that came out of the federal idea, the expansion of RTI, and I think, again, thank you to the federal Congress for doing that. But I want to thank you all for this opportunity and certainly would stand for questions or further input as we move down the line.
Thank you. We'll give you feedback on your tie after the meeting.
Okay. Hi, my name is Jim Grathwell with Minneapolis Public Schools. I'm not the chief academic officer, Bernadia Johnson, as promised on your agenda, so I apologize on her behalf. But I'm happy to take a minute and repeat some of the things you've already heard and maybe add a little value at the end. Minneapolis Public Schools supports the spirit of No Child Left Behind. We think there's problems on implementation and mechanics that you've heard a lot about. One, assessment. The standards are not uniform across the 50 states. Comparability is compromised if the standards are set at different levels across the state. You've already heard testimony about a cross cohort versus a growth model. We've worked very well in the state of Minnesota with our Department of Education moving and with policy leadership from this body and across the street or on the other chamber to get that growth model. So I think we've made a lot of progress there that Representative McCollum could bring back or show it can be done. We're doing it in Minnesota, and it could be replicated nationally. I think we've already touched on internally in the state of Minnesota, we still have to maintain comparability, continuous changes to our assessment instruments, whether we include ELL here or they're using a different kind of test. There's always changes going on that affect baseline comparability, and we're working on that. It's been addressed that the issue of how we treat special education students learning disabled versus those with significant cognitive impairment. We have a school, Jefferson School, 28th and Hennepin, meeting all AYP standards for 8 of the 9 subgroups. It has a citywide developmentally cognitive disabled program. Students who, I think, under the point Mr. Kronquist made, probably have little or low chance of making a proficiency standard because of who they are. And I have a school that's going to be penalized. It's doing a great job just because of one subgroup. I think other school districts could tell that story. Perverse incentives. The current law has perverse incentives to misbehave. Superintendent Jennings in Chaska talks about a perverse incentive to set lower standards so you have more schools making adequate yearly progress that currently exists. Under that special education treatment, Jefferson School would be best served to not be on the AYP list by outsourcing that program to an intermediate school district. We think it's better for students to be educated in their home community and by in their home school. And by choosing that, the school site is punished. Perverse incentive to just focus on students who are right at that proficiency limit. So that's a problem. And I'll just say, in closing, the NCLB isn't taking place in isolation. It's within that IDEA mandate. It's within the mandate to desegregate schools. How are we doing on some of those other mandates, funding IDEA? If we don't have a commitment to housing, it's going to be hard for schools alone to do that deseg mandate. And then we are working within a current labor relations framework that conflicts with some of the needs of No Child Left Behind. So we should look at how those interact.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Sam Walseth with the Minnesota Rural Education Association. Lee Warren, our executive director, is unable to be here today, so I'm filling in his place. I'm going to be very brief, Mr. Chairman and Congresswoman McCollum. You've heard a lot of excellent testimony, especially from my colleagues up on the panel today with me. What I hear from our members, about 150 school districts in greater Minnesota, is basically this. No Child Left Behind either needs to evolve into a meaningful system of accountability or it needs to go away. And what those same members will tell you is they don't want it to go away. They want it to evolve into something meaningful. School districts want to be accountable for the achievement of their students in their buildings. But it needs to be an accountability that and a measurement that is meaningful to the actual students, the individual students in those classrooms, and their teachers and the administration that they're working with. Simply put, we've got a lot of our districts in my membership use the Northwest Education Assessment, the NWEAs. They love it. They've been using it for years. It's a way that they can actually measure individual, get real-time student information in those classrooms. The teachers can and the administration can use that information to make changes immediately in their classrooms and in their curriculum, getting test data after the fact and then getting a new cohort of students isn't meaningful. It doesn't help the school district improve its classroom achievement. So we would ask that Congress be willing to allow some flexibility there for our state to use those growth model assessments. That's very key. Mr. Chairman, with that, I think I'll close because you've got you've heard a lot of testimony today, and you've got another important witness after us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And if there's time before 12:30, we'll open it up for additional question. Before we get to the commissioner, Kim Miller, if you'd like to give us a two-minute presentation, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for fitting me in this morning. I'm Kim Miller. I work with the Center for Advanced Research on Language Acquisition at the University of Minnesota in the Immersion Projects. And I'm speaking today for a consortium of immersion schools in Minnesota. Language immersion schools are schools that teach content in a foreign language. And with the goal of additive bilingualism, meaning that by the end, certainly of elementary school, which would be K-5 or K-6, students are functionally bilingual in English and a second language. It's a highly enriched language experience for children. In 20 years ago, we had two immersion schools in the state of Minnesota educating under 100 students. This fall, September 2007, there are over 40 elementary and secondary immersion language immersion schools, including two-way immersion schools that work with native Spanish-speaking students and native English-speaking students together in the same classrooms. In speaking with the administrators for this consortium of schools in Minnesota, two things have become evident and are of concern to them. You've heard a lot about testing. The same goes for administrators and educators in immersion schools. Students who are being educated, who are receiving initial literacy training in a language other than English, are in some respects similar to ELL students. Many of these students speak English as a first language, but when they're being tested, especially at second and third grade level, they are still operating within a program of initial literacy in another language. So these administrators would request that there be some flexibility to perhaps test in that language. At least in the early years. Research shows that by the time students have finished an immersion elementary education, they are doing very well in standardized testing in English, so that is not an issue. The second thing would be the highly qualified teacher requirements. Administrators are finding it very difficult to find teachers who are near native fluency or native fluency in a foreign language to teach content and also have some understanding of immersion pedagogy and are requesting that there be some flexibility again. Other states have managed to find ways to get waivers for a short period of time while teachers are working on a licensure that they need. Anyway, that there be some flexibility in terms of how we find teachers so that they are able to find qualified staff to teach in these programs.
Thank you very much, Ms. Miller. And Commissioner Segrin, and thank you for your patience and listening carefully in the front row, never getting up once. And I'm sure that you've listened carefully on a number of common themes that have come up, so we'll presume that'll be addressed in your remarks.
I will certainly not be redundant if at all possible. I think the bottom line, I think what you've heard, and thank you, Congressman McCollum, for coming. It's good to see you again. Is that the main problems with No Child Left Behind is in the areas of special education, English language learner, and also how we are using our test results to give us feedback to improve our instruction and improve the student achievement of our children. I'm having passed out to you, and this was delivered to your office shortly after I was put together. All of the congresspeople and senators at the federal level did receive this. This was a consensus document that was put together at the request of Senator Wigger. We came together with all of the different groups, including the superintendents, school board representatives, chief state school officer. We looked at all of the national platforms around No Child Left Behind, and we put together this consensus document that actually distills, if you will, the main points and the main concerns that we have about No Child Left Behind. And we deliver that to your office, and I will certainly let you read that at your leisure. But it reflects many of the comments that have been said today. There is a strong consensus that we need a fair way of identifying schools making adequate yearly progress. And there are suggestions, and I spent Labor Day weekend reading the draft of the House legislation that has been proposed, and I want to make a few comments about that before I leave, and before you have to leave. Especially, as I said, in the area of English language learners and special ed. We are committed, and I am as commissioner, to the principles of No Child Left Behind. But I'm fearful that if this law is reauthorized, that it will become more bureaucratic, complex, burdened with paperwork, and more punitive. I say that because in 1974, IDEA was authorized. And in 1975, my son was born. And we benefited greatly because my son was handicapped from IDEA. It was truly a landmark civil rights act. But as the years have gone by, the complexity has become so burdensome, and the paperwork requirements and the regulations have really taken away from the ability for teachers to really instruct. They're spending more time doing paperwork and meeting regulations than they are instructing. I don't want No Child Left Behind to end up becoming that, and I'm afraid that we are on that path. I wish that we could have some common sense within this law. We are focused here in Minnesota on academic rigor. We're not running away from it. When we first established our adequate yearly progress goals, we came together as a stakeholder long before I was commissioner, as stakeholders, to say we do not want to set low expectations for our students. So I'm very proud of the fact that we did not game the system originally. But right now, we are moving forward. In spite of No Child Left Behind, we are going to be requiring that all eighth graders take Algebra 1, and for graduation, all students have to graduate with an Algebra 2 coursework plus two more years of math. We have 3 years of science required, which includes biology and a choice of either chemistry or physics. And we're doing things continuously to make sure that all of our children are having the opportunities to learn. With the legislature's help, we also increased the funding for advanced placement and international baccalaureate and college in the schools dual enrollment programs. Because of that funding, our students, the increase in participation has risen by 20%. And the scores of those students scoring a 3 or better in the advanced placement courses has also grown by 16.5%. That's an incredible growth in the numbers of students that are participating. And happily, we have more of our African-American students participating in advanced placement. Those are the kinds of benchmarks and measures we should be seeing. How many more students are taking more rigorous courses? How are we moving them into this and supporting them and creating the kinds of opportunities to build capacity? In addition to that, we also, the governor had proposed that we create math and science academies for teachers, so that we, again, come alongside of our teachers to help support them professionally, to bring, and Senator Kelly, I appreciated his comments, to really bringing the wow factor into our classrooms, not merely standing up and saying, open your textbook to page 3 and let's begin, you know, learning the next math course, but really learning how to do this with relevancy and with excitement. that those math and science academies will be implemented starting in late January or early spring. So those are some really wonderful initiatives that we are doing as we're moving our system along in an effective and positive way, in spite of No Child Left Behind. I really do appreciate the work that you are doing at the federal level, Representative McCollum. I'm so glad that you're here to listen to our concerns. In regard to the proposed draft, there's been some talk about the multiple measures that you could get points for those. It says, however, that you have to have more tests, and I think that in this state and in this climate, if we propose that all students now take a social studies test to get a 5% bonus point, I think that we would have rebellion on our hands. It also says that you can have advanced placement as a bonus measurement, if you will. We certainly have advanced placement, but the requirement is that every school and every class have advanced placement. We are moving the dime in a different way. We are moving this by putting funding and support and training into our advanced placement international baccalaureate programs, and we're measuring the progress disaggregated. And that's the way I think you should look at it. What is the progress over time? We are actively pursuing a growth model. We are in process of pulling together our stakeholders. We will have some presentation of some examples of growth models that districts can choose from. We also are concerned, and I am personally, I have been for a long time, that we are focused on the low-achieving student, but we're forgetting that the typical and the gifted student should also be demonstrating a year's worth or more of growth also. And so if we have a growth model, it is my desire that we also have indicators so that we are also measuring the progress of those students and not forgetting that we have many, many children that need to excel. There are our English language learner. I'm disappointed that we don't have more flexibility, at least a 3-year minimum time period by which we could have an alternative test developed for those students and let states be able to measure that progress over time. And then, you know, after appropriate level, then go into the regular MCA2s. I would hope that that would be advanced, that we could have the opportunity to do that. And have more flexibility in that area. I do appreciate the fact that there's an attempt being made to have priority and high priority schools where you would not be dinging, if you will, school districts that have one or two subgroups that don't meet AYP for 1 year and then the next year they're okay, that there's at least some indication that there's a chronic problem. And so I appreciate that flexibility that's being considered. And that those districts would not necessarily be dinged, if you will, for AYP, but there would also still be the requirement for school improvement plans. I think that there, you know, is some movement in positive directions. I love some of the grant opportunities that are available, especially in advanced placement, the awards for distinguished schools. I think it's important for us to award schools for the progress that they have made and to give effort for that. I also am concerned about defining effective teachers and saying that if you are a new teacher, you're not effective. I think that the definition is unfair. And I think that that needs a lot more discussion if we're going to be talking about who is, are that if you are out of field, that you're not an effective teacher. We have some extraordinary teachers in our rural areas who have been teaching for 25 years, and they may be teaching one, they may be a biology teacher and teaching one course in chemistry, maybe have had many, many years of CLEs that could demonstrate that they're just wonderful to teach that chemistry course, and to call them not an effective teacher is really insulting. So I think I understand the reason behind it, to make sure that you are not having poorly educated teachers or teachers in really hard-to-teach situations where they really need to have the support, and I understand that, so that our minority children are not being robbed of an effective teacher. But we need to address it in a different way, I think. No Child Left Behind has assured equity, however, for our children, and I think that's really important. The statement that all children can learn, that whether you, no matter what the color of your skin or how much economic economy that you bring or how much money you come to the table, whether you're poor or wealthy. It shouldn't matter. We should have the expectation that all children can learn. And that's the great equity. I think that's the great strength of No Child Left Behind. It has assured equity for all of our children. So the implementation, though, has been difficult, and we spend half of our budget now on testing. And I would like to spend more like maybe a third or a fourth of our budget on testing, and I'd rather see a lot more of our budget on professional development, on working on strategies that will really help students improve and help our teachers to be successful, and do some of the positive things that I know, and put money into advanced placement, put money into lots of strategies that we know can really help children succeed. And so if you can send us any help with our testing budget, that would be great. It's very difficult. We also did propose having an RFP for a formative assessment to come alongside of our MCA2, because we do recognize that a diagnostic test is important, to give all districts the opportunity to have that formative test. Unfortunately, that did not get funded. We're going to try that again to see if we can't have a statewide opportunity for all districts to participate in a formative test.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. We just have a few minutes, and members, as you know, we have several subcommittees that are in the process of addressing many of these themes, and we'll be talking about that in subsequent meetings. I'd like to turn over the meeting to Congresswoman McCollum, who would like to share some remarks and perhaps a reaction to Commissioner Segrin's remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to thank the committee members who are here. I would encourage the committee members to feel free to pick up the phone. Chow Lee does education work here in my Minnesota office. Emily Lawrence just left to catch a flight. She does our work in Washington, D.C. We're back quite often. Public education is a high priority in our office, and you're right out there. Listening to people in your local schools and that all the time, so I would really encourage you to share with our office. Commissioner Segrin, I really appreciate you going through, and I'll share the remarks that you shared with me back to Chairman Miller. I have concerns on the testing, as you pointed out. The effective teacher, when we look nationally. And as I said, I didn't support Leave No Child Behind, but I was shocked nationally. Some school districts, some school buildings, there isn't a teacher who took any classwork in that topic teaching any of those classes at all. If that makes any sense. I mean, it's even hard to say because it doesn't make any sense. I'm a licensed social science teacher, and I can teach seven topics, and I could maybe, co-teach something else with some a literature novel class or something was working into history in that. But we looked at some states where there's no licensing for teachers, and teachers, there's not one science teacher in a whole building. So everybody's teaching out of field. And it was for that they were trying to address. But that's what's wrong when we try to do things federally and broad sweeping. We don't allow for common sense flexibility where it is appropriate, and common people, the common sense, just stands out with individuals. But I do want to ask you on this. One, the president and his budget. They cut out school counseling, drug and safe-free schools. I mean, it was a list of like 26 things, just zeroed out. And when I asked Secretary Spellings where schools would go if they wanted to continue part of these programs, not every school might have every program but part of it, she said, well, if it's important enough to a school, they can take it out of Title I. Now, Minnesota's Title I funding was in effect cut with a formula change several years ago, was it not?
Yes, it was, because of our poverty rate declined.
One of the things that Secretary Spellings is unable to provide me is the number of students and unmet needs per state for Title I funding. And I know you've got a lot on your plate, but if you could at least get me Minnesota's, I'm working with a few other states to get what they have. And then the waivers. Waivers seem to be handed out with no rules to them at all. But I do want to know if Minnesota has applied for a two-year waiver for English as second language, and if we've been turned down. Secretary Spellings won't even tell me who's applied for things. Many schools started doing two-year waivers in the early years, 2003, 2004, 2005. In fact, it was so popular, and they made the case so strongly for it that was something that the Department of Education actually promulgated by some rules to allow English as a second language. And then secondly, did the department help you at all? I mean, I'm so pleased that Minnesota shoots high for standards. I am. But being caught up in Leave No Child Behind has unintended consequences for us constantly moving our standards up. So every time we raise standards, it's my understanding that puts us farther and farther behind from being able to apply for the growth model, as some states are beginning to apply for growth models. So my question to you is, as Minnesota this last time ratcheted up its test standards, did the Department of Education say, hey, you might not want to do that right now if you're in the middle of applying for a growth model? Because I know you're a strong supporter of the growth model. I've heard you talk about it time and time again, and I know you to be one of the most wonderful, sincere people when it comes to working on public education. But we got caught here at home with not being able to go into a growth model because we changed testing.
We are able to do that now. And one of the things that we didn't do, I think because of past experience with the implementation of No Child Left Behind, first of all, we wanted to see what the framework would be for a growth model, what they would approve. So we weren't sure that what we would have liked to have done was going to be what they ended up approving. So we held back just to see what the first five were going to look like as far as a growth model. And then in that process, also, we did revise our language arts and our math. When the first iteration of the five that came out that were first approved, one of the regulations or requirements was that you had to have at least 2 years of data, test data, before you, which makes sense for a growth model. So we are now able to do that. And we also, I think, had the benefit of watching what was approved and not approved. I was not excited about going in and spending literally weeks and months developing and devising a value-added or a growth model and then going to the feds and saying, nope, oops, no, because of, and not just putting the two-year thing aside, I had no idea, no one knew all the other kinds of requirements that were going to happen, and indeed, there were lots of other, complexities to it. So I think we were, and this was a consensus, it wasn't just the department. We have a stakeholders group, and I think we all agreed we wanted to wait and see what this was going to look like before we spent a lot of time, because the rules have changed. We were told 2 years ago or 3 years ago that we could have a cell size of 40 for our ELL and special ed kids. And then last year we said, nope, you have to go back to a uniform. And so we have gotten very gun shy to do anything until we kind of see where it's going. We are now very aggressively going to do a growth model, and hopefully it will meet the approval of the feds. If it doesn't, we're still going to go ahead with it and use it in our own way if we can in the state.
Mr. Chair, one of the things I'm going to try to push for is a stop the clock amendment or something in here, because states like Minnesota, and we're not alone, states like Minnesota who followed the rules, who thought the money was going to come, who felt that they could make changes, that they would be treated fairly. In states like Minnesota that as our legislative auditor put out, they're the ones that are going to have schools failing. All schools will fail unless we stop the clock and reset it to something that is fair and something that is balanced. So, Commissioner, I'd like you to think about that. I'd like to work with you. There's several other states. I would like both the Senate and the Minnesota House to look at that. Because if we don't stop the clock, we've been playing by the rules. And you just heard the commissioner say she wanted, you know, to do a growth model. At the same time, they didn't know if it'd get approved. They wanted to accelerate the standards. When we accelerate the standards, that's what makes the formula destined under the federal Leave No Child Behind to make all our schools fail. So we need to figure out a way to stop the clock, take a look at what's happening here, and really make sure that all children succeed, and we do it in a way that is transparent, is accountable, in a way in which it makes sense to parents and to those students upon graduation that we did everything we could to make sure no child was left behind. Mr. Chair, thank you so much. This has been helpful. I've got notes all over the place. And I really do encourage people to pick up the phone. We have copies of the draft here, or you can find it on the Education and Workforce Committee site, which is www.house.gov under Education and Workforce. And 60,000 people had downloaded it as of a week ago, so I'm sure there's a lot more downloads now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
On behalf of the committee, thank you, Congresswoman McCollum. We'll work together on this. And Commissioner Segrin, thank you, and to all the testifiers and others that joined us today. Committee's adjourned.
Thank you. Thanks so much. This is great.